boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to the 411 Ground and Pound Radio Show, your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Robert Winfrey, and thank you all for being here. If you're listening live especially, I know you've probably got the terrible commentary from WWE Survivor Series muted in the background if you're a professional wrestling fan, and you're listening to me instead of, you know, their commentary, which is just atrocious. So thank you for that. Listening after the fact, thank you as well. I really don't care. You know, as long as you're listening, I thank you for it. If you listen 5 years down the line, someone just discovering this episode, thank you. Hopefully I'll still be alive in 5 years, but thank you anyway. All right. On the agenda tonight, got to review last night's UFC Fight Night 78, the finale of the Ultimate Fighter Latin America 2. I will not make the joke. Tired, so I won't be saying it. And we'll be previewing next week UFC Fight Night 79. Next week's card starts early in the morning here in the States. It is the UFC's debut in South Korea. Benson Henderson fighting Jorge Masvidal in the main event. Two different guys named Dong Yun Kim. I kid you not. Same name, exact same name. Names are. I understand the differences, you know, that not intimately, mind you, but it's one of the reasons with like Latin cultures, you get some weird names, weird being a relative term, you know, we of the, you know, westernized Anglo persuasion, when it comes to our naming schemes are pretty straightforward, at least as far as, you know, what we're used to. And you get some weird, again, various Latin cultures have a lot of different names. You like carry a bunch of surnames from your maternal side sometimes, and it can just get, you know, it's one of the reasons you get so many weird names for like Brazilian fighters, because it's easier to just know them by their nicknames. And in Korea, I don't know, maybe Kim's a very common family name over there, and it's kind of like the equivalent of, you know, John Smith. I don't know, but there's two different guys named Dong Yun Kim. One's on the prelims, one's in the co-main event. So I'll be talking about that. I've got to warn you all right off the bat, I am on my own tonight. Jeff Harris told me yesterday he had prior commitments this evening. That's fine and dandy. I appreciate Jeff being on the show. And even when he's got other stuff that takes priority, I completely understand. You know, he should be back next week, for those of you who are going to be missing him. In the interim, it's just me. Or if any of you would like to call in. See, this show, it goes live, and I take live callers. So if you are listening live and you want to call in, ask a question, get your opinion out there about, you know, anything in the world of MMA, if you had some thoughts about the Rousey-Holm fight from a couple of weeks ago, from, you know, last week, and you just now want to get your, you know, you've just now formulated your opinion, you want to get your thoughts out, you have another question for me, whatever. If you want to call in using if you want to call in using either a traditional landline cell phone, just if you dial, basically, the number is 323-657-0901. Once again, 323-657-0901. If you want to call in using Skype, you have to be on the Blog Talk Radio player page. There is a Skype icon on the top of the player, pretty much in the middle. Well, centered, I suppose, is a better descriptor there. It's centered near the top of the player. You click that, there's three or four boxes of dialogue to click through, then you'll come to my switchboard and I will get you on the air. So if any of that strikes your fancy, feel free to call in. I always take live callers here. It's been a tradition since long before I actually hosted the show, so if any of that strikes your fancy, call in. I'm happy to, you know, take your calls. All right. Up first, let's go ahead and jump into the main event then. I have a gripe about UFC Fight Night 78 that I'm going to save until after I run down the card. Normally, lately I've been doing my gripes first. I want to save this gripe to the end. A pretty specific reason. But main event, 3 weeks ago, the main event was supposed to be Kelvin Gastelum returning to welterweight to take on Matt Brown. Good fight. Matt Brown has some pretty hefty name value, you know, had big winning streaks. You know, Matt Brown's pretty awesome in a lot of ways. Kelvin Gastelum, former Ultimate Fighter winner, not that it matters at this point, mind you, coming back to welterweight. His last fight was at middleweight because the guy blew weight twice. Before last night, his fight against Tyron Woodley. He missed weight by 10 pounds. He weighed in at 180 pounds. Now, I know non-title fights, they'll give you a 1 pound allowance. The welterweight division still ends at 170 pounds. That's why title fights, you cannot have that 1 pound over. That's where the division stops. Again, non-title, they don't care as much, so they'll let you, but it's still again, if you want to be very technical and nitpicky, you are missing weight. They'll just forgive it if it's within that pound. Now, again, so technically speaking, he missed by 10 pounds. 9 pounds if you want to give him the grace. He missed weight badly. Beat up Nate Marquardt for 2 rounds, decided he was coming back to welterweight. He's been insistent about it. UFC finally said, fine, you get one more shot at welterweight. Well, first of all, he made weight. So good on you, Kelvin Gastelum. You have accomplished the bare minimum of being a professional fighter. You made weight, and as far as I know, you haven't failed a drug test. Beyond that, he looked pretty good. I mean, there are other times when Kelvin Gastelum has either made or missed weight, and he's looked awful. He didn't. He looked darn good. He switched his camp up. I forget where he was. I think he was actually fighting out of one of the Arizona camps. Not the lab, but a different one, and I don't remember which one. But he left them. He's now with Kings MMA. And they seem to have done him a world of good. He looked like he had no problems making weight. And he had no problems performing over 5 rounds. That was a big look. I thought if this fight, the longer this fight went, the more it would favor Neil Magny. Not necessarily the case, is it, in actuality. So his conditioning was on point. Very, you know, very good to see that. He made weight, had no issues fighting over 5 rounds. I mean, this wasn't the highest paced fight, but he didn't gas. And, you know, credit. Because I didn't think he could, you know, perform consistently across 25 minutes. But he did, so good for him. This was supposed to be Matt Brown. Matt Brown got injured 3 weeks ago. His partner, his training partner, because Matt Brown now fights out of the Elevation team in Denver, Colorado. Neil Magny stepped up, and Neil Magny likes to fight. And I don't mean that as a stylistic in-cage thing. I mean, the guy has fought 5 times this year. He fought 5 times in 2014. They talked a little bit about it on the broadcast last night. He's the first guy in the modern era to have 10 fights in over a 2-year period. And if you go back and look at some of the other guys who can contend with that particular record, that's a lot of one-night tournaments. And, again, we all kind of count those differently. But Magny keeps doesn't get injured, apparently. And over those 2 years, going into last night's fight, he was 8-1. He only lost to Damian Maia. And Damian Maia is no slouch. Now, the fight itself. Neil Magny wins a split decision. I don't want to say controversial split decision, because I think controversy implies it was wrong. This was a close fight. This was a close decision. And none of the scores were outlandish. There were a few other fights that we'll get to on this card that I thought had some dubious scoring, even if the right guy won. That wasn't the case here. You had two 47-46s for Magny and one 47-46 for Gastelum. That's 3 rounds to 2. And it's pretty clear now. Neil Magny won the first round. I was shocked. Neil Magny's grappling improved tremendously. I said when I was breaking this fight down, if Neil Magny was going to win, there were a couple of things he needed to do. He needed to keep Kelvin Gastelum at range, because Neil Magny has something like 8 inches of reach on the guy. Neil Magny's physically bizarre. He's got 80 inches of reach, all right? That's insane for that division. But he would need to keep Gastelum at range, utilize a good jab, keep him off, and he had to be able to execute takedowns, because we didn't know if Gastelum was any good off of his back. Neil Magny did both of those things. Utilized his range very effectively in the first couple of rounds. Gastelum had a really hard time adjusting, getting in close. landing punches, getting takedowns. Magny had some good takedowns from the clinch, and again, his grappling surprised me. He was there with Gastelum in the scrambles. Gastelum's a pretty good scrambler. He's very good at, you know, capitalizing on little mistakes, at keeping momentum going on the ground. You know, there's things that he does very well. His transitions are very good. The way that he took the back and choked out Jake Ellenberger was a masterclass in capitalizing on, you know, split second lapses from Ellenberger, and he was able to get the back, lock up the choke, just, I mean, very, very quickly. Very good on the ground. And Magny was, those first two rounds, Magny handled him on the ground. I mean, we're not talking, you know, the same type of handling that you got, like Damian Maia gave to Magny, because, well, Damian Maia might have the best jiu-jitsu in MMA. It's like between him and Paul Harris in terms of pure jiu-jitsu. But Magny was doing very well. He was keeping dominant positions, had the back for long stretches of time, didn't get caught up in, you know, a lot of the things that anytime Gastelum would try to sweep, Magny would counter. He saw it all coming, kept good control, landed blows here and there, worked for submissions. Those first two rounds were very good for Neil Magny. The third round is where things get dicey. Kelvin Gastelum starts being much more effective in the third round. He's pushing a little bit better pace. He starts getting inside the range of Magny and, you know, kind of landing his punches. The clinch work wound up being a bit more even in that round. Magny, I think, surprised Gastelum with his takedowns from the clinch those first two rounds, and Gastelum finally kind of adjusted, being a lot more even. The third round it's the swing round in this entire fight, is how you scored round three. And there's arguments for both men. I gave it to Magny. I believe he had a takedown in that round. He had some top control. Magny was landing more blows than Gastelum through three rounds. The fourth and fifth started changing that, but he didn't have a lot of heat on them, whereas Gastelum was really trying to, you know, end his night. Gastelum did a lot of forward motion, and if you rate that very highly, then you can Magny utilizing movement and trying to utilize his reach. If you overvalue forward pressure, then you gave that round to him very easily. Thankfully, the argument for him winning is not that he was moving forward. There's a much more comprehensive argument. He was moving forward. He had good work in the clinch. He was actually landing some good shots. There's a legitimate argument for Kelvin Gastelum to win that round, and it's not just he was moving forward. But if you were to, again, if you overvalue forward pressure, then I don't think you consider round three to even be that close. You just give it to Gastelum without thinking. I gave it to Magny, but again, you give Gastelum round three. I don't think you're wrong. I'm not complaining at all. You know, that was a very close round. Round four, Magny gets clipped and dropped twice. There's an argument for a 10-8 round in round four. I didn't go that way because two reasons. Yeah, Magny got dropped. I don't think he was close to being finished either time. And if you're going to base a 10-8 round on striking differential, I think that's an important component, is how close were they to being finished? And, you know, does the guy on the receiving end of the beating, you know, fight back, or is he just barely trying to survive? I mean, again, there's a lot of things that kind of go into it. I don't think it was a 10-8 round. I think there's an argument there. And again, if we accept that there should be more 10-8 rounds given in MMA, there are borderline 10-8 rounds. And I'd accept this was borderline. And if you're feeling, so again, I didn't go that way, but I think there's an argument. There is an argument to be made there. Gastelum clearly wins round four. Again, I went 10-9 because Magny was never that close to being finished, and he kept fighting. You know, he was not battered from pillar to post. He got clipped, bought himself time to recover both times, and then resumed fighting. So I don't think it was a 10-8 round. But again, there's an argument there, and I don't think it's wrong necessarily to give that round to Gastelum 10-8. Round five was another back and forth round. It was another Gastelum round. He was, again, starting to land his punches a little bit more. He got some takedowns that round and was able to kind of out-hustle Magny in the scrambles to maintain, you know, top position. Spent a lot of time in Magny's guard. Magny had a takedown at one point, tried to get the back, but couldn't get both hooks, wound up on his back with Gastelum on top. Again, a back-and-forth round, but another round for Gastelum. So the whole thing hinges on how you scored round three. I haven't seen the individual scorecards, so let me say this. Gastelum winning round one or two, or Magny winning four or five is wrong. Just flat out wrong. Those are both of the, all four of those rounds were pretty clear. So logically, the whole thing hinges on round three. And I thought Magny won that round. So again, big win for Neil Magny. I mean, Gastelum was ranked below him, but Magny was an underdog here. A lot of people were picking Gastelum. I picked Gastelum. He again was the underdog. This was the second biggest fight of his career in terms of both card placement, name value for opponent, opportunity to improve his stock. The biggest one, of course, being the fight with Damian Maia that he lost. But, you know, a big, big win for Neil Magny. He's now 9-1 over the last two years in the UFC. He's got to be, I mean, for the rankings, he's got to be in the top 10 at this point. Maybe just at number 10, but come on, he's doing great work. For Gastelum, you know, the loss is a setback. That always sucks. But there were some really good things to take away from this. One, his striking, it looked a lot better. His understanding of range and distance still needs some work, but he's starting to, you know, put some combinations together against a mobile opponent. It's one thing to tee off, you know, five or six punches on Nate Marquardt when Marquardt is just kind of covering up against the fence. Anybody can do that. Marquardt's a punching bag at that point. I could do that. It's another to try and get those combinations going when your opponent is moving and circling and sticking a jab in your face. And Gastelum did a much better job of kind of, you know, integrating combinations into his overall movement plan. His footwork and movement still need a little work. He was letting Magny off the hook a few times. But those are minor things. Those are things you get with experience and drills. And he's with Kings MMA now, which is Rafael Cordero's team. Rafael Dos Anjos and Fabricio Werdum both fight out of Kings MMA, and you know, their careers have come up tremendously. Gastelum's still very young. He's only 25, I think. Might even be younger. I need to double-check that. Yeah, he's 24. So, young guy in that respect, you know, moving up in the world. He's with a good camp now. You know, based on his performance last night, I would say he's with a better camp. Because even though he lost, he looked, you know, physically he looked great. He fought five full rounds. I mean, this wasn't the fastest paced, you know, back and forth wild brawl type of fight, but it was five rounds of doing stuff, of moving, of punching, of, you know, clinching, grappling. You know, the guy fought five rounds and did not gas out. So that's a huge positive he can take away from this. Again, there's an argument that he won the fight. If that decision goes his way, I'm not crying that Neil Magny got robbed. I might disagree, but it's not wrong. That third round was very close, and that's what the whole fight hinges on. So again, there are positives for Gastelum. Magny's got to get a higher ranked opponent next, unless he takes another short notice fight, which he seems to enjoy. Magny kept a good pace for five rounds. He got a little bit tired down the stretch, but he never, you know, gassed out the same way that you see, you know, heavier fighters do, or even lighter weight fighters when they just get exhausted. He never got exhausted. He might've got a little tired at the end, but he'd fought, you know, you fought over 20 minutes. The fifth round, you're going to be tired. Unless you're, you know, one of those freaks like Demetrius Johnson or Frankie Edgar. I mean, those guys, I don't think it's possible to actually tire out either of those two guys. Benson Henderson's another one whose conditioning doesn't get enough play. That guy just does not get tired. Cutting a lot of weight to lightweight, he didn't get tired. It's an underutilized component of the game. And, you know, Magny acquitted himself well, especially in a short-notice fight. A lot of guys taking a fight on 3 weeks' notice might not have agreed to a 5-round fight, because that's a superb level of conditioning that he's maintained. I used to joke about, you know, I need to explain the whole joke. For those of you who have ever heard me refer to Neil Magny as future UFC welterweight champion, it started as a joke. I lost a bet involving Neil Magny with Mark Radulich when he fought William Macario. I said on Twitter, I believe, or on Facebook, something to the effect of, oh, great, Neil Magny's fighting. Well, this is 15 minutes of my life I won't get back. Neil Magny used to frustrate me to no end because he had, again, 80 inches of reach, tall guy, and he had no idea how to strike, no idea how to strike on the ground. He just did a lot of, you know, kind of crappy jabbing and clinching without a whole lot to it, and he frustrated me to death. So Mark joked that, no, I think he finishes, and I'd like to bet on it. And I said, fine. I was pretty confident Magny wouldn't get the finish. He said, okay, if Magny gets a finish, then you have to declare yourself president of the Neil Magny fan club for the next 2 months. On this podcast, anything I wrote, I identified myself as such. I said, fine. I wasn't sure what I was going to call if I won, but in that fight, Neil Magny got a finish. So I would come on here and jokingly, and I figured if I'm going to be president of the Neil Magny fan club, even just, you know, as a gimmick, I should refer to him as future UFC welterweight champion, because that's what you would do. So that's where it started. My time doing that wound up, and I kept the joke about him being future UFC welterweight champion in part because it amused me, because he got good. I mean, Neil Magny improved as a fighter, and I started – it very kind of subtly transitioned from being a joke that amused me and probably no one else to, no, you know, he might. I mean, he's not beat – I mean, again, Kelvin Gastelum is the biggest name he's beaten, and I'm not sure if I'd pick him over, I mean, even like Stephen Thompson or, you know, I mean, some of the top guys, you know, Tyron Woodley, Carlos Condit, Rory McDonald, you know, the top of the division, I'm not sure I'd pick him to beat. But that lower part of the top 10, he's coming up in the world. I mean, he's with a good camp. He's shown consistent improvement in his skill set. I mean, Robbie Lawler's not going to be on top forever. Robbie Lawler's not a young man. And a year, 2 years from now, is it really that crazy to think if Neil Magny, again, let's say he doesn't fight 5 times next year. Let's say he fights 3. Say he wins all 3. If he wins the next 2, that 3rd one should be a title eliminator, just by virtue of his winning streak at that point. At which point, he's fighting for the belt, and he could take it. I mean, it's not the craziest thing I've ever spouted on this podcast. So good win for Magny. He goes into, again, 9-1 over the last 2 years, currently on a 3-fight winning streak? Oh, 2-fight. He again, the loss to Maya was at UFC 190. He beat Eric Silva. That fight should not have been a split decision. It just shouldn't. He beat Eric Silva decisively. Then beats Kelvin Gastelum, much closer fight. But he got the win, and, I mean, he had a, he had a 7-fight winning streak snapped by Damian Maya. But that's his only loss in, again, 10 fights. In 10 fights, one loss to Damian Maya. That's nothing to sneeze at. So, good win for Magny. He should be fighting someone, again, lower part of the top 10 next. I don't know who the UFC has there at this point. Let me pull up the UFC's rankings. Now, I don't think these have been updated since the fights last night. So, I will apologize and have to make a couple of minor adjustments myself. Rick Story is currently number 10. Stephen Todd, Tarek Saffiedine would be nice next for Neil. I mean, again, Neil Magny is currently 13. How he dropped below Thiago Alves of all people, I'm not sure. But you got Rick Story, Tarek Saffiedine, who would make good fights for him next. Dong Young Kim, again, who's fighting next, who's fighting this coming Saturday. Kim wins, that wouldn't, because Kim's fighting a no-name. A late-notice replacement no-name, but he's fighting a no-name. And if he loses, you know, then Magny and Kim would be an interesting fight. I mean, that, you know, those 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 spots, he should be fighting someone in that range, and he'll probably beat them. Again, I'm not sure about Stephen Thompson. I think Stephen Thompson's actually underrated at number 8 at the moment. But he'll beat the rest of those guys. He'll beat Rick Story, I think. Well, let me put it that way. I'm not sure about Gunnar Nelson. But I wouldn't count him out against Nelson either. I mean, again, Neil Magny is doing very, very good work. So, good win for Magny. You know, bigger things in his future. Kelvin Gastelum, he made weight. He fought hard for 5 rounds. Those are both big things in his favor. The UFC likes him. And, again, if he's got his weight issues under control, he's fine at welterweight. The issue with him has been making weight and performing. If last night was an indicator, now there's your qualifier, it might have been an aberration, but if last night is the type of form, if that's the type of form he's going to have, making weight and then fighting, he's fine at welterweight. So good for him. We'll see what's in his future. That one fight of the night, apparently, it's a pretty good fight, especially last night. There were some not good fights last night, some really not good fights. But, you know, again, happy for Magny. The man continues marching on, you know. There's, if you don't mind the joke, there's still plenty of room on the Neil Magny bandwagon if anyone wants to jump on it. I do get to claim that I was calling it long before other people in some ways, but, you know, you could do a lot worse than, you know, rooting for Neil Magny nowadays. He's doing good work. All right. Co-main event. Diego Sanchez got beaten badly. Man, Diego Sanchez dropping to featherweight, that was a horrible idea. Let me say that. Diego Sanchez, he becomes, I think, the second guy to fight in 4 different weight classes because he won the first season of The Ultimate Fighter at middleweight. Dropped to welterweight, dropped to lightweight, now fights at featherweight, just like Kenny Florian, the guy he beat at middleweight to win the first season of The Ultimate Fighter. He looked awful at the weigh-ins. I mean, his arms were thin, his forearms, his whole gut was sucked in, his face looked different. I mean, he looked awful physically. He made weight. I wasn't entirely sure he was going to. Just honestly, I was not sure he was going to make 145 pounds. He did. He made it to, I think, 146. But he made weight. He rehydrated like 30 pounds. I mean, there were reports by people who, you know what they're talking about, that fight night, so 24 hours after weighing in, he was walking around at 171 pounds. I mean, that is an obscene weight cut and then rehydration. That is not healthy for your body. It's just not. Then he goes out. Now, he got a really tough draw for his... Look, Ricardo Lamas is not a champion. Ricardo Lamas, I don't think, will be a champion. I mean... Again, he's lost to Jose Aldo for the belt, and he's lost to Chad Mendes, and I don't think he'd beat Conor McGregor. And I don't think he'd beat Frankie Edgar. But those guys are elite. And that word gets overutilized. They are special. Jose Aldo is one of the 2 best fighters in the world. I love Demetrius Johnson to death as a fight fan, but I haven't been able to justify ranking him over Aldo yet. That might change a couple of weeks when Aldo and McGregor fight, depending on how that goes. Not just winning and losing, but performance-wise. And John Jones is eligible to be ranked again now, so John is now the best fighter in the world by virtue of being John Jones. But Jose Aldo I have firmly at number two. And Chad Mendes is no joke. Chad Mendes hits hard, good wrestler. You know, I mean, again, the guys that Ricardo Lamas can't beat are magnificent fighters. And he beats everybody else. You know, we live in this world where our perception is if you are not good enough to actually be the champion, that somehow lessens you. Ricardo Lamas is a darn good fighter and a very good featherweight. If I were making my featherweight debut, he is one of the last guys I would want to fight. And Sanchez got beat. He got beat bad. The first round just picked apart, wobbled by a wheel kick. I mean, Lamas never got sucked into a brawl with Sanchez, and that's what Sanchez does at this point in his career. He wants you to stand in front of him and go roadhouse. Just swing leather, and whoever falls down, falls down. That's what he wants you to do. Gilbert Melendez indulged him in that and nearly lost a fight in the third round that he had dominated. Ricardo Lamas did not do that. He fought technically. He fought intelligently. He utilized, again, jab, good combinations. Sanchez fights southpaw. In the second round, Lamas landed this really nasty low inside leg kick right into the calf and ankle, and Sanchez's lead leg was done. He started hopping and limping. Backed up to the fence because he, again, to put his back against it so he doesn't have to put all of his weight on one leg. And then tried to goad Lamas into wild exchanges with him. Lamas never did that. He stayed calm, he stayed composed, and he stayed technical. We got some fun grappling exchanges out of these guys, too. For those of you who haven't seen this fight, it's worth watching. Lamas landed that inside leg kick again a couple of times. I mean, and I need to bring this up because this happened on one of the prelim fights, Scott Jorgensen and Alejandro Perez. At the end of the first round, Perez landed, I think this was an outside leg kick. I'd have to rewatch it. I forget if they were. No, yeah, it was a low outside leg kick. And it wrecked Jorgensen's lead leg, so his left leg. He had to hop back to his stool. I mean, he could not put weight on that leg. They came out for the second round, and I have to yell at the ref in that fight. But my point is, Perez cracked him again to the leg a few times. Jorgensen actually switched southpaw to defend, you know, to keep it away from being kicked, but it was hurt. He was limping on it. It looked almost identical to Jamie Varner and James Krause when Jamie Varner's ankle was broken and he couldn't move his foot. He couldn't put weight on it. He kept stumbling and tripping over it. And I yelled at the ref in that fight. And I'm going to yell at the ref. I believe it was Gary Copeland in the Jorgensen fight when I get to it on the prelims. But the point is, Sanchez and they both the winning fighters, both Lamas and Perez, had this problem. They hurt their opponent. Their opponent starts hopping on one leg, and they seemed confused about what to do. That's not a circumstance you practice for. And here's the thing. It should be. Now, I understand if you're in the gym, sparring, training, you know, drilling, whatever. You kick your opponent to the leg. You're just practicing low leg kicks, let's say, and you jack them pretty good. And they start hopping around on one leg, you don't hit them again. Because they're your training partner, you don't wish to injure them. But it creates this muscle memory and this pattern of, okay, someone gets hurt like this, I back off, I hold up. And it was a mistake. I mean, look, I appreciate that Lamas did not want to get sucked into a brawl, Diego Sanchez. But he almost seemed confused as to what his next attack should be at some of these times. because it's a situation that he was not drilling for. And it's something that I think might need to be incorporated more into camps. Preparing your fighter to attack an injured opponent. And it's an odd thing, and I mean, you should absolutely, I'm not sure how you would, you know, set it up. Apart from, you know, you tell everyone beforehand, okay, you know, sparring partner, at some point I want you to, you know, pretend your leg is injured. I'm not, you know, and we want to get him to react to it. If you're actually hurt, you know, have a safe word or something. That, you know, okay, wait, no, I'm not faking. I'm really hurt. That actually stops it. But otherwise, you know, get your guys used to attacking someone when they're injured. Because the ref, if the ref doesn't stop it, you keep going. Now, it was a little bit different in the Sanchez fight than in the Jorgensen fight. But, again, Sanchez got beat up, just abused. After his leg got compromised, you know, Lamas was grappling him. Again, fun grappling exchanges. Landed a spinning elbow, was trying flying knees. Sanchez had almost no offense. I mean, Sanchez didn't get finished, which is to his credit, I suppose. Because, man, his leg got jacked. I mean, again, those low calf kicks, there's some stuff there you can mess up. I mean, the ankle's right there. There's some nerves right there. Again, the muscle, the calves aren't used to being kicked the same way the thighs might be. His leg was jacked. I joked that, look, Diego Sanchez gets clucky decisions more than anyone. Including, again, his fight with Ross Pearson. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Worst decision I have ever seen in MMA. Just flat out. Worst. And I said before this fight, as it was going on, the final bell rings. I actually said on, I think it was Facebook, and I put it in my coverage, if so much as a single round went to Sanchez on any judge's scorecard, I was busting out Cthulhu. Because there was no way. There was no legitimate method of scoring that gives Sanchez 1 minute of one round of that fight. He got beat. Start to finish, pillar to post. I think I actually gave Lamas a 10-8 third round. I mean, that dominant. Just great stuff out of Lamas. He reminded everyone that he's a darn good fighter. Diego Sanchez should not fight at featherweight. Just flat out, should not. If this was indicative of how he performs at featherweight, he should not fight at featherweight. And that's not just him against Ricardo Lamas, because again, Lamas is a very good fighter, but he had none of the pressure that he normally brings, none of the wrestling aggression, none of the long combinations, all the stuff that fans of Diego Sanchez like, he didn't do. I don't know if it was all physical and have to do with the weight cut, but I bet a chunk of it was. And he should not fight at featherweight. He's losing. If last night was an indicator, he is losing way too much to make that weight, to ever be anything approaching a legitimate featherweight fighter. You have some guys that are unranked and maybe making their debuts. Yeah, he'll beat them. But no one who really kind of knows what they're doing in that division is going to lose to him. It's not even close. Again, good win for Lamas. Again, Lamas is out of the title picture for right now. But he's still very good. I mean, again, he lost to Jose Aldo and Chad Mendes. I mean, those are great. Those are two of the very best in the world at that division. It's just not an indictment of his skills that he couldn't beat Jose Aldo or Chad Mendes. It's not. All right. Next up, we had another look. Every fight on the main card went to decision. In fact, if you watched this thing from start to finish, like I did, the last 8 fights went to a decision. Oy. It got tedious in a hurry. Just because a fight goes the distance doesn't mean it's a bad fight. But, first of all, none of these were great fights. There were some good, again, there were good fights. All right. Lamas and Sanchez was a good fight. The main event was a good fight. But there's a lot of fatigue that goes into watching this much of a, watching this much fighting. And especially when a lot of it is repetitive. And there was some repetitive stuff in this fight last night. There was a lot of it. And you're going to get events like that, I understand, but I'm just saying, there was a lot of it. All right, at flyweight, Henry Cejudo defeated Jussie Formiga. This had some odd scores. It was a split decision win for Cejudo. Cejudo had two 30-27s, and then Formiga had a 29-28. I had a 29-28 Cejudo. I thought Cejudo won rounds 1 and 3, and Formiga had round 2. Round 2 could have been a Cejudo round. I'll say that. I thought Formiga's strikes were a little bit better that round. I thought he did better work in the clinch that round than he did in the others. And I thought Cejudo maybe didn't, I don't know, I don't want to say he took his foot off the gas, but he was less effective in the second round than he was in either of first or third round. So I thought Formiga edged out the second round. I don't think you can give Formiga either of the first or third rounds. I mean, I don't see it. Cejudo remains unbeaten. This likely sets up Cejudo for a title fight. I don't think he beats Demetrius Johnson. Cejudo has a really, first of all, Olympic gold medalist in freestyle wrestling. I mean, his pure wrestling credentials are superb, of the absolute highest quality. This is MMA. This is not freestyle wrestling. And even then, there are different approaches to freestyle wrestling. I mean, Mark Munoz, for example, was much more of a counter wrestler than he was an aggressive takedown machine. And counter wrestling only gets you so far in MMA if you're not fighting someone who's going to try and wrestle you. So there are just differences. Cejudo he's physically quite strong in the clinch. As evidenced in this fight, he has great takedown defense. I mean, he might not always get takedowns, but I have a really hard time seeing anyone, and again, this includes Demetrius Johnson, taking him down. His boxing it's solid, but it's not spectacular. He was able to just kind of outland Formiga a little bit in rounds 1 and 3, outwork him a little bit in the clinch. This was not a great fight. And look, Cejudo cuts a lot of weight to get to flyweight. Over 5 rounds against Demetrius Johnson, I don't think he's got it. I mean, again, Demetrius Johnson is technically, in terms of technical proficiency and skill set, the best fighter in the world. He integrates his striking into his grappling. He meshes things very well. He has, does not get tired. The way he pressures you and makes you work, there are guys, again, flyweight is a fast-paced division. Guys carrying a lot less body weight. They're able to keep a high pace. Demetrius Johnson wears out other flyweights. That's the kind of pace he keeps. That's the kind of pressure he puts on you. He can fight however he wants to fight. He utilizes, if he is worried about your striking or thinks it's too even a matchup or thinks he's just better on the ground than you are, he can out-wrestle you. If he's not sure he's a better grappler than you, you're going to have a hard time taking and keeping him down, and he's going to beat you up on the feet. If he's not completely confident in either of those areas, he will get you in the clinch and just utilize knees, elbows, uppercuts from the clinch position. That's what he did. Again, Ali Bagatinov, a superb grappler, combat sambo world champion. Demetrius Johnson owned him in the clinch. You have to be better than Demetrius Johnson pretty much everywhere, or so much better in one area and good enough to avoid the others again, if you're a spectacular striker who can keep a pace and avoid being taken down and circle off the and avoid the clinch, then you've got a shot. I don't think Henry Cejudo has that. I just don't think he does. I think he's earned his title shot. I don't think he beats Demetrius Johnson. I don't think anyone right now at flyweight beats Demetrius Johnson for the next 2 years. After that, again, flyweight is a division built on speed and technique, and as soon as that's in reflexes, as soon as that starts slipping, you're going to have a hard time getting it back and recovering. And at that point, someone else might take over, but for the next couple of years at least, I don't think Johnson loses that belt. I think he's just so complete a fighter that no one is going to be able to beat him. But good win for Cejudo. Again, still unbeaten, should get the next title shot. I will be interested to see how he and Johnson match up, because there's some interesting things there. You know, we haven't seen someone really try to take Johnson down since he fought Benavidez the first time. So it'll be interesting to see him adapt to that, you know, how he deals in the clinch with someone who's so physically strong, how his striking will match up. You know, it's an interesting fight. I'm always interested to watch Demetrius Johnson fight. All right, we have the two finales, the two finals fights for the Ultimate Fighter Latin America Season 2. Both these fights sucked. Eric Montaño defeated Enrique Marin via split decision at welterweight. I scored it for Marin, but round two is your swing round and could go either way. Marin clearly gets round one. Montaño clearly gets round three. Comes down to round two. I gave it to Marin, but you give it to Montaño, I don't care. The fight was not good. Enrique Barzola defeated Horacio Gutierrez via unanimous decision, 230-27 and a 30-26. Gutierrez could not stop a takedown. Could not get up. Could not utilize an offensive guard. Barzola took him down, stayed on him, hit him. Repeat. Not a good fight, but a dominant win for Barzola. And kicking off the main card, Leandro Silva defeated Efrain Escudero via unanimous decision. I hate Efrain Escudero. You want to know why? I got a couple of reasons. One, his fights suck. The man is a boring fighter. Two, he sucks. His skill set is severely limited. He fell in love with his ability to throw a right hand early in his first run in the UFC because he knocked out one dude. And now all of a sudden he thinks he's a knockout artist. Not even close. His striking is rudimentary at best. He started, and this is another thing he picked up, I think between his first and second. The guy's had a really weird history with the UFC. One season whatever of The Ultimate Fighter. Wins his next fight against Cole Miller. Then loses twice. Gets submitted by... I want to say he got submitted by... the heck is his name? I can't remember that guy's name. Dunham. Evan Dunham. I want to say he got submitted by Dunham. And then he came in overweight and got submitted by Charles Oliveira. Came back, lost three times, got cut again. I think during that, between those first and second runs, he picked up a habit of letting guys shoot and grabbing guillotine chokes. That's fine if you're fighting people who don't know what they're doing when it comes to adequately shooting takedowns and protecting their neck. But it was a bad habit he got into because he was fighting a lower level of competition. He got back to the UFC. His return fight for that, his return bout for his second stint, he kept giving up takedowns because he tried for guillotine chokes. And it never worked. And he lost a decision. Anyway, he got brought back a little bit ago, lost his return fight. He won two in a row, but they were over nobodies. And here he fought Leandro Silva. Leandro Silva is not the best fighter in the world, but he's not bad. And Escudero had nothing. He won one of the rounds. I can't remember which one, actually, off the top of my head. Might have been the third round. But Silva just beat him up. Again, this was not a great fight, okay? I need to reemphasize this point. This was not a good fight. But Silva just, you know, was able to land cleaner shots. I think he rocked Escudero at one point. But fought a good fight, you know, avoided what Escudero's good at, landed good punches like he likes to. I think he had to, again, there were some grappling exchanges. The fight itself was nothing special, but Leandro Silva walks away with a unanimous decision, 29-28. This fight is one of the reasons I never pick Efrain Escudero to win. I just never do it. Don't think he's very good. And his fights are not very good. And I don't like him as a fan. I've never met the man personally. And I know that, again, the UFC is not the only MMA game in the world. There are other fighters. There are other fighters out there worse than Efrain Escudero. I am aware of this. But I don't really care who it is he's fighting in the UFC. I almost never pick him to win because I have a hard time seeing him beating anyone who is good enough to win in the UFC. I just have a really hard time seeing it. And I'm wrong every now and then. Again, he had won two fights before this. But they were not over, again, as far as the UFC goes, they were not legitimate competition. Leandro Silva is not a big name or even a great fighter. His only loss in the UFC is to Francisco Trinaldo. He submitted Charlie Brennan and had the weirdness with Drew Dober. So, he's not a bad fighter. And I think if you're good enough to have a winning record in the UFC, you're going to beat Efrain Escudero. All right. Real briefly going through the prelims. At bantamweight, Eric Perez defeated Taylor Lapolis via unanimous decision, 329-28. No issues. Perez had kind of a rough first round, I think, and then started picking it up in the second and third. He's a bit of a slow starter. Good to see him back. He'd been out for a while with injuries. Good to see him back on track. The guy still got submitted by Brian Caraway, and it'll take a while for me to forgive that one. At welterweight, Bartosz Fabinski defeated Hector Urbina via unanimous decision. There's a little cluckiness going on here because one of the judges gave Urbina one of the rounds, and I don't think you can do that. I think Fabinski had all three rounds. Not sure which round you would even give Urbina. I'm just not. It wasn't a good fight. Look, Urbina could not get up after being taken down, could not stop the takedowns. His whole game plan seemed to be, I'm going to grab a submission, I'm going to grab a choke as he's trying to take me down, and I'm going to finish him. You didn't, and you had no plan B. He got taken down. He got, punched and elbowed in the face for three rounds. You watch the first round of this fight, you don't need to see the other two because that's the same thing that happened over and over again. Alejandro Perez defeated Scott Jorgensen via the TKO ankle injury. All right, this is where I have to yell at Gary Copeland, who was the referee. I yelled at Jason Herzog for this same situation in the fight between James Krause and Jamie Varner. If a fighter cannot stand upright, they cannot fight. Now, whether this is because they've been hit in the head or because there's an injury to the leg, you can't stand, you can't fight. If you see a fighter hopping around on one leg, unable to put weight on a foot, at a bare minimum, you call a time in the action and you get the doctor to check on it. The ringside doctor is not just there for cuts or eye pokes. They are there to assess the fighter's health and safety. If all that was wrong with Scott Jorgensen was a muscle cramp. If he got hit really hard in the calf and it Charlie horsed bad on him, then the doc can tell you that. He can feel the muscle, he can feel the structure, and let you know that there's nothing. It's a non-issue. Fight can continue if he wants to continue fighting. That type of thing happens in fights and is not going to. A pause to check that kind of injury, that kind of issue, does not negatively affect the fight. And all you're doing is ensuring fighter safety. The referee did not do that. He let Scott Jorgensen, this happened in the second round. At the very end of the first round was when the big kick happened that hurt his leg. Apparently it injured his ankle somehow. Might have broke it to some degree because, it looked like Jamie Varner's issue where the foot would not respond when he moved it. The ankle was not functioning. His foot would not roll. It would drop off. That's why he kept tripping over it. Normally, when your foot is working properly and you lift up your foot, through years of, walking, your body will respond to the commands of your brain. Your foot will move, it will pivot, and it will plant so you land firmly on on the heel, on, the part of your foot you're supposed to stand on. With a broken ankle, the foot doesn't respond. It just flops. Now, this means that if you're taking small steps, like you tend to when you fight, instead of all of your foot coming up and remaining, flat to the ground, parallel with it, so you can just go up and down, it flops to one side. And if you, lift up half an inch and the outside part of your foot does not, remain parallel with the rest of it, if it now flops over on an angle, when you try to step over and put weight back down on it, you're coming down on the side of your foot and you're going to trip. That's because your ankle isn't responding properly. This happened to Jorgensen multiple times. And the referee, he got close and was looking at it. Now, Jorgensen started the second round by going to the southpaw stance to kind of defend that injured leg. That's intelligent. And again, if it's a muscle issue where he just got kicked and the muscle seized up, it'll work itself out. I appreciate the referee giving him the opportunity to see if that was, an injury worth stopping the fight for or worth, checking out. Well, a couple of minutes later, it's still there. It's still an issue. Jorgensen's still getting beaten up. The referee did nothing to protect him. His corner. And I yelled at Jamie Varner's corner. When they were watching him flop around on one foot, one of your jobs is to protect your fighter. If your fighter cannot stand, throw in the damn towel. Scott Jorgensen's corner, it was borderline irresponsible. You could hear them calling out to him, look how good you're doing with just one foot. Yes, because you should have sent out a man to fight, to engage in a fist fight, when he couldn't stand on one foot. That was irresponsible. The referee, first of all, he should have stopped it sooner. All right, Jorgensen kind of got tuned up in that second round. He couldn't stand on one of his feet. You can't fight that way. The referee, minimum, time the action, get the doc to check it. The doctor should know if it's a serious injury or not through a very routine examination. You feel it. Does anything feel broken? Can you move your foot? Feel the muscle. If the muscle is, seized up and isn't relaxed, then okay, you've seized the muscle. I can't stop the fight for a muscle spasm. If you want to stop the fight because you have a muscle spasm, that's fine if you're the fighter. But, that's the minimum he should have done. Jorgensen kept trying to fight on it. And look, you step awkward. You can roll your ankle just stepping awkwardly. If it's already injured and you're stepping on it wrong over and over again, you're just going to exacerbate the problem. And there's all these, and again, the referee's job is to protect the fighters. His corner's job is to help look out for his well-being. All these people watched this happen and fundamentally failed their fighter. Shame on you. Shame on the lot of you. Jorgensen, I don't know why he tried this, but what actually led to the fight ending, he tried a wheel kick, some kind of spinning. I think it was supposed to be a wheel kick. On his bad leg, or with his bad leg, it failed miserably. I don't think he could even fully extend it. And if the calf muscle was compromised in some way, of course he couldn't extend it. That's part of what it does. And he fell over, and he actually had to tap out. Just tap the canvas. I'm done fighting. I'm injured. The fact that there were people whose one of whose fundamental jobs is to look out for the safety of these fighters failed him that badly is disgusting. And now, this was another instance. Again, I talked about this with Sanchez, where Lama seemed not quite to know how to handle an injured opponent if the referee isn't going to stop the fight. This is going to sound heartless in many ways, but this is prize fighting. It's a heartless business. Look, the Korean Zombie threw his shoulder out against Jose Aldo. Jose Aldo's response was to launch kicks at that shoulder. If the referee does not stop you, you keep fighting. Perez seemed to freeze up. Because here's Scott Jorgensen hopping on one leg, getting his back on the fence so he can have some balance. And again, in training, you stop at this point because you don't wish to injure your training partner. So now you are conditioned to halt when this happens. That's great for the gym because you don't want to kill anyone. It's bad in a fight when, you know what, yeah, I want to take your head off. That's the reality here. Perez had opportunities to end this fight that he did not capitalize on because he seemed frozen. Now, you can say that maybe it's, you know, human empathy. You know, he didn't want to hit a guy who's already hurt. I appreciate empathy. I really do. But you're in a prize fight. You get paid if you win. The physical suffering of your opponent is a non-factor to you when that cage door is closed. And Perez should have capitalized on those. I mean, again, if he had hurt Jorgensen with a punch and Jorgensen was wobbly, then he would have gone after him because he is conditioned to know what to do in that case. And he wasn't in this instance of, oh, this guy can't stand. And, again, I feel a little bit bad for Perez because he was clearly not in a position he was comfortable with. At the same time, the job of the referee is to tell you to stop. If he doesn't, your job is to hit the other guy or choke him or whatever you do, however you choose to go to win the fight. And Perez just seemed confused and a little bit befuddled and almost like, I don't want to hurt this guy anymore. Empathy's a great thing unless your job description is hurting other people. And believe it or not, that's your job description in prize fighting. Hurt the other guy. So, a bit of an issue there, but Perez gets the win. Officiating, again, Gary Copeland, shame on you. Andre Feely defeated Gabriel Benitez with a head kick and punches. Not a whole lot here. A lot of circling. Benitez just couldn't get his defense up in time for the head kick. Good win for Feely. On Fight Pass, Alvaro Herrera defeated Vernon Ramos via knockout in the 30 seconds into the first round. Win for Herrera. These next two fights were filler from the season of The Ultimate Fighter, so I don't know anything about either of them. Then Polo Reyes defeated Cesar Arzamendia. I have to object. One of the reasons the UFC's promotional, some of the stuff they do as a promotion, some of the things that commentators do, bothers me. Because this man was being referred to as Marco Polo Reyes. I don't know which of those is his first name. I don't know which of those is his nickname. Referring to fighters on commentary and in promotion only by their nicknames just creates this culture of ignorance. I couldn't find anything on this guy for my, you know, pre-fight blurb that I type out in my coverage because I didn't know who to look for. There's a lot of guys with Marco, Marcos, various spellings with the last name of Reyes. There's a lot of them. That's not an uncommon sequence of names, you know? So I couldn't find anything on the guy. But beyond that, look, let's take Ronaldo Souza. If all you know of him is what the UFC has told you, how they promote him, how the commentary teams refer to him, you think either his first or last name is Jacare. Jacare is his nickname. But because of how he is referred to by the UFC, by the UFC commentators, that creates confusion. The UFC has never put Mirko Filipovic's last name anywhere in their promotion. They always refer to him as Mirko Krokop. Krokop is his nickname. He's a Croatian police officer. His last name is Filipovic. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, at least. It's some variation on that. All you have done is to create ignorant fans. That's what you've accomplished with this. Again, this bothers me, probably more than it should. But all the UFC does with this is foster ignorance amongst its fan base. And it's irresponsible. I mean, look, if a fighter wants to be known predominantly by their nickname, if that's how they like to be referred to, I can appreciate respecting that. Got to make it known. This is why you put quotation marks around nicknames. Look, Godofredo Pepe Castro. Pepe's his nickname. All the UFC or John Anik or Kenny Florian or Joe Rogan or whoever, they all refer to him as Godofredo Pepe. Now, if that's all you know, you think that's his full name. Now, look, Henan Barao wants to be known as Henan Barao instead of Henan Pegado because that's his actual last name. Again, his last name is Pegado, not Barao. If he wants to be known as Henan Barao, that's fine. I would just appreciate it if the UFC would, you know, and Barao's case might be a little bit different. But with some of these guys, it's just not a good thing. I was watching some old UFC fights the other day, and constantly Rogan and Goldberg would refer to people by their nicknames instead of by their actual names. And all you do is confuse your fan base. All you do is foster ignorance. And it bothers me. And kicking everything off, Michel Prezeris defeated Valmir Lazaro via split decision. 229-28 for Prezeris, 129-28 for Lazaro. I think I scored this for Lazaro. I don't care. The fight was not good. All right, before we move on to UFC Fight Night 79, and I'm going to have to go through that pretty because I'm running out of time here. This event, UFC Fight Night 78, was a long event. For UFC 191, 192, the last one, let me check. I think it was 190, might have been 193. 193, okay, for Rousey versus Holm. Someone in my coverage thread who is, I would imagine not, doesn't watch a whole lot of MMA, but was following along, posted the question, what time is the main event going to start? Might have been for the event before that, but the point is, one of these, someone was curious, because I assume they lived on the East Coast. The average UFC event wraps up 1 a.m., technically Sunday morning, 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, that's wrapping up. They try to get the main fighters, the main event, to the cage, give or take midnight. That, at the very least, that's when they like to do the walkouts. Now, that's annoying if you live on the East Coast, because you have to be up until 1 in the morning. Last night's event, the main event, did not start until I believe 12:45. That fight wrapped up closer to 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time than to 1 a.m. This fight, this event took forever. And the top two fights were fine, but I imagine they lost half their audience by that point, because who's going to stay up until 1 a.m. to watch Neil Magny and Kelvin Gastelum start? It's just not going to happen. This was not the only incident of this issue raising its head for me. I cover a lot of MMA. A couple of years ago, there was a finale of The Ultimate Fighter, I forget which season, that was headlined by Nate Diaz and Gray Maynard. You can look this up if you like. I provided coverage for that, and I complained loudly in coverage. This event is taking forever. There were some issues with that event. The main event at the last minute got changed to Diaz and Maynard, so it was only 3 rounds instead of 5 rounds because of the last minute switch. They were already scheduled to have the airtime as though the main event was 5 rounds, so they had a lot of airtime to kill. The point being, there were segments of that event that went, John Anik introduces promo package for one guy from one half of the finals of The Ultimate Fighter of the season. Commercial break. Come back. Commercial break, come back. Promo video package for the other guy. Commercial break, come back for fight introductions. It was boring. It took forever. And I caught some flack for it from the readers. Again, to anyone out there who thinks I might be making this up, you can go in the archives of the MMA Zone of 411 Mania. You can find this event. I forget which one it was, but it's headlined by Diaz and Maynard. And you can read the comments, because they still exist there. This event had a similar problem. The two fights that were the finals of The Ultimate Fighter Latin America, welterweight and lightweight, took up from the first introduction of a video package to the final interview for the winner, 80 minutes. 80 minutes. That killed the momentum of the show as a fight card. It takes forever. The viewer stops caring. The viewer changes the channel. The viewer may not come back. This is one of those events that if I was not covering it, I would not have watched these fights. I would have watched the last two. Three. I would have watched the last three. The featherweight or the flyweight fight. The featherweight fight with Sanchez and Lamas in the main event. Everything else on this card I would have ignored. And the fact that those two fights and their video packages took up 80 minutes is just stupid. It's just poorly planned television production. It kills viewer interest in fights. I understand you want to have the Ultimate Fighter. I understand you want to have the finals. Put them on the prelims. Doesn't even have to be Fight Pass prelims. Go ahead and put them on the FS1 prelims. The whole event's on Fox Sports 1 anyway. All you do by putting these on the main card is drag down pacing, the interest, and the energy of the whole event and your viewers. Please fix this problem, because your events drag on long enough as it is. Having them drag on longer with fights that no one cares about that wind up sucking is just unfair to your fan base, casual and hardcore alike. Please fix this. All right. Next week, early Saturday morning, UFC Fight Night 79. UFC's debut in South Korea. Whole event's on Fight Pass. I will have live coverage over in the MMA Zone of 411 Mania, so please stop by and say hello as I'm doing this. I've started a running gag with Mark Radlich, wherein he's going to come in and say, I just want to let you know we're all counting on you, a riff on the airplane gag, and I'm going to come up with some, you know, bizarre circumstance whereby his motivation keeps me going. The main event for this card was supposed to be Benson Henderson taking on Thiago Alves at welterweight. Apparently Benson Henderson likes being at welterweight. Good for him. He fights just fine there. Thiago Alves got injured. We bumped up Jorge Masvidal. The fight's still at welterweight. Both guys were fighting at welterweight anyway. Both guys, former lightweight fighters. Benson, of course, former lightweight champion in the UFC. I was going to pick Henderson over Alves, not by a lot, but I think I was. I have very little problem picking him over Masvidal. Masvidal, good boxer with some brawling tendencies, but I have a very high opinion of Benson Henderson's skill set. His ability to fight intelligently, style with which he fights, is very smart. I'm a fan of Benson Henderson, and I think he'll beat Masvidal here, especially over five rounds. I imagine he'll submit Masvidal in the fourth or fifth. That's just kind of how I see this playing out. But this is still a good fight. Henderson, you know, might crack into the welterweight rankings if he's winning here. That's two in a row. I mean, granted, Brandon Thatch is not exactly world class in the sense, you know, top 15 of the division, but he's no one to sneeze at. And again, Masvidal may just be making his way into welterweight, but he won his welterweight debut. He stopped his opponent, if memory serves. He knocked out Cesar Ferreira. Prior to that, he got robbed in a fight with Ally Aquinta. He should have won that fight. That was a bad decision. But I think Benson Henderson, especially over five rounds. If this was a three-round fight, maybe I'd lean a bit more towards Masvidal, but over five, I think Henderson has this pretty comfortably. Masvidal's fought five rounds before. In Strikeforce, he fought Gilbert Melendez for five rounds, but Benson Henderson is, I think, better than Gilbert Melendez. And a very different style of fighter, too. So I got Henderson, again, late finish, fourth or fifth, probably a submission. Co-main event, Dongyoung Kim was supposed to fight again Masvidal, but Masvidal moved up to replace the injured Alves. Dongyoung Kim will now be fighting Dominic Waters, who I believe is making his UFC debut. I need to double-check this. Dominic Waters. No, I think he's got a UFC fight, actually. He might have one. He lost to George Sullivan. Okay, I remember. Oh, yeah, his UFC debut, lost to George Sullivan. This is kind of a gimme for Dongyoung Kim. Kim is a native South Korean. Benson Henderson is half Korean, really wanted to be on this card. Another reason I'm picking him, I think he's got some emotional investment here. Kim will have a big, big support. He's, you know, again, South Korean MMA is coming up in the world. He's a big reason for that, his success. So he's going to have a lot of support. I was going to pick him over Masvidal, I think, but now he's fighting, again, kind of a can. So, should be a showcase for him. Next up, Yoshihiro Akiyama will take on Alberto Mina. Surprised Akiyama's still fighting, actually. I thought he might have retired. He's coming off a win over Amir Sadala in September of last year, so he's been out for a while. Prior to that, he was on a four-fight losing streak. His only wins in the UFC are over Alan Belcher and Amir Sadala. He's lost to Chris Lieb and Michael Bisping, Vitor Belfort, and Jake Shields. So looking for his first UFC winning streak, if he can win here against Alberto Mina, I think he will. Mina, I don't think has fought in the UFC before. I'm going to double check that. No, he has fought once in the UFC. He's fought, he beat Shinso Ansai. It was a good fight. I'm just remembering it now. But okay, so he's got one win, but I think Akiyama will beat him. Not a given, And Akiyama's, got a lot of mileage, but Akiyama's a pretty safe pick there. At featherweight, Doohoo Choi, who has a win in the UFC. He knocked out Juan Pugh 18 seconds of the first round. The Edgar versus Swanson card. I remember that. Not vividly, but I remember. Man, I do remember that. That was a pretty good, that was a pretty impressive win. Sam Cecilia has fought in the UFC a few times on a two-fight winning streak. His UFC losses are to Maximo Blanco, Hani Jason. He's got a pretty extensive record. He's been with the UFC for, he's had quite a few fights. He's been with them for 3 years. On a two-fight winning streak against a guy who's looked good, man. I've got a tough time picking against just this tough, well-rounded wrestler like Cecilia against an unproven commodity like Choi. But Choi's unbeaten. Choi will probably be the... If I got to pick an upset, I'll take Choi as an upset pick. All right. On the this whole thing is on Fight Pass, by the way. So if you don't have Fight Pass and just want to follow along with me, I'm happy to... happy. If you want to watch it, again, Fight Pass. The original main event or co-main event for this card was a heavyweight bout between Mirko Krokop Filipovic and Anthony Hamilton. Krokop injured his shoulder, retired. Turns out he failed a drug test as well. And Hamilton got pulled from the card altogether. Almost a poetic ending to Mirko's career. Look, the guy spent most of his time in Pride, and I just believe everyone who fought in Pride was on something because there was no drug testing at all when they were in Japan. So long time, probably has had some use of various PEDs. His last win over Gabriel Gonzaga avenged a loss that forever altered the trajectory of his professional fighting career. So between, that being his last fight and injury, drug, it's a very kind of poetic and not in the sweetest way, but a very kind of poetically fitting end to his career. And I don't mean that as an insult. But on the prelims, we have Yuichul Nam taking on Mike De La Torre. Nam, again, there's a lot of Korean guys here. Nam lost his UFC debut was a split decision win over Kazuki Tokudome. Then he lost a decision to Felipe Nover. Another split decision. I seem to recall thinking that he got screwed in that fight. I thought he got cluckied. I did not think Nover won that fight, now that I recall. Taehyun Bong is back against Leo Kuntz. I actually like Bong. He's coming off of a loss to John Tuck. Knocked out Cajun Johnson before that. He's just kind of a fun brawler. And I don't think Kuntz is of the caliber that, guys like Mirbek Taisimov or John Tuck are. And they're the guys who have beaten him. Again, I think rather highly of Taisimov, actually. But next up, Dongi Yang will face Jake Collier. Collier's fought in the UFC a couple of times. I don't remember his record off the top of my head. Yang has fought in the UFC before. He lost to Chris Camozzi, beat Rob Kimmins, and then lost to Court McGee and Brad Tavares and was cut. He won his two fights since that and is now returning. I think I'll take him over Collier. Not sure, but I think I will. We have a women's strawweight bout between Seo-Hee Ham, who has fought in Invicta, if memory serves. I'm confusing her with someone else. Excuse me. She lost a unanimous decision to Joanne Calderwood in her UFC debut, but that was a pretty good fight. And Joanne Calderwood, legitimate strawweight. So she'll be trying to get back on track against Courtney Case. I'll go with Hom here. I don't know anything about Case. At flyweight, we have Yao Zikui. I'm going to have mispronounced that. He'll be taking on Freddy Serrano. Serrano's fought in the UFC before, I want to say. Yeah, he knocked out Bentley Seiler. He's only 2-0. He got his start because he was on one of those seasons of The Ultimate Fighter, probably one of the first Latin America season. Yeah. Very inexperienced. I want to see the other guy's record real quick before I make a prediction here. Because I want to say he's actually fought in the UFC before.